Jacqueline Daly, Danielle Turner, Stanton Jones. Demarc Snow also produced by Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Andre Lewis, Matt Needham. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip hop programming, how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme writing and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church in Portland. The Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival features seven new music performers, performing works by living composers, both well-known and lesser-known, as well as some works by recently deceased 20th century composers. Music by Lou Harrison, Jacob Druckmann, Julia Wolf, David Lang, and many, many more. Again, that's the Spontaneous Combustion New Music Festival, happening January 19th through February 10th at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8:01, and coming up next is Positively Revolting. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Avett Brothers, live in concert this July for three nights at McMenamin's Edgefield. Tickets for the Avett Brothers at Edgefield are on sale at edgefieldconcerts.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Hey, good morning, good morning. It is about 2 minutes after the top of the hour, and you are tuned to your very own community radio station, KBOO Portland. You're listening to Positively Revolting, and this morning I'm your host, Ani. So, looking at this week, something really significant happened. Okay, many significant things happened, but I speak of Ursula K. Le Guin crossed over last Monday. Le Guin has long been a hero of mine. She has been one of the greatest writers of speculative fiction, leaving us with more than 50 years of rich reimaginings of how we see the world and how we see ourselves in it. As I thought about her passing, I realized how profoundly my own experience, how profoundly my own perspective had been informed through her imaginings, and by extension, how vital the role of speculative fiction is in the movement to remake and shape the world to be a place that focuses more on compassion, egalitarianism, and the very rights of the earth that sustains us all. So, to help with this conversation this morning, to talk about the importance of speculative fiction in the world and in the revolution, I am excited to welcome Todd Davies back to Positively Revolting. Todd is the author of the History of Arcadia Visionary Fiction series. The fourth book in that series is called Report to Megalopolis, or Postmodern Prometheus. And we look forward to that book coming out in August later on this year. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, Ani. Nice to be here.
So glad that you are able to join us again this morning. It is always good to have a chance to talk with you, especially as we look at not just the role, but the importance, the critical nature of speculative fiction and revolutionary acts. And to start us off this morning, I want to just sort of remember a quote, one of my favorites, from Ursula K. Le Guin, and that is, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words." And I thought that that is a wonderful way to sort of start us off this morning. Do you have any initial thoughts responding to that?
It's funny because I was thinking about that quote. Well, I was thinking about many of those quotes this morning. And first, I have to thank you for helping with my own personal grief therapy this week for passing.
Right.
Because this is a great way to deal with that. I was thinking about the fact that story being what makes up everything, makes up our meaning and makes up how we see the world and makes up how we interact with it. You could think of capitalism as one of those books that you read when you were a kid that you absolutely loved and thought was just wonderful. And then you read it again when you're an adult and you've outgrown it and you have to move on to another story. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was what she was doing in her massive work, was moving on from that story.
Mm-hmm.
So that quote really encapsulates that. I mean, she actually, I think, should have given herself more credit and should have given words more credit and should have given story more credit, because every change that has ever happened has happened through some kind of change of meaning, which usually happens in story first.
Absolutely. I mean, I absolutely agree that we are made up of stories. The idea that as long as, people tell our stories, we live. As long as we are telling stories, we are a part of a legacy, part of a change, chain of history into the future. We create all of our society based on the stories that we tell about ourselves and about how we interact with each other. So when we invest in stories, when we popularize stories of tough guy cops, stories that maintain status quo, stories that prop up the world we live in, that says one thing. But when we want to reach beyond the world we live in and create something new, where do we find those stories?
In ourselves. Mm. Obviously, because we are constantly evolving, and the stories come up from a very, very deep place. And you can see that happening, right? You can see that it's exploding right now, and there's pushback happening from the older stories. This is why her work is so important, because she was consistently pushing back and consistently pushing forward. One of the things that was so amazing about her, and which I think is really important about speculative fiction that you're talking about, or her fiction, was somebody in the New York Times wrote an obituary about her this week that was titled that she was not categorizable, which kind of irritated me, because that was the whole point. The obsession to categorize things and make something dominant over something else is actually what she was pushing against.
Mm-hmm.
She was constantly working in different areas. I need to say something about fantasy, because it drives me so crazy.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy when people say, "I don't like fantasy. I just like real stories."
Why does that drive you crazy?
And why are you laughing, Ani? Tell me why you're laughing.
I wanted to hear why that drives you crazy, because I agree. That irritates me.
Well, because where do you think the real story came from in the first place? Hello?
Yes, exactly. So,
you know, I mean, it's like a teenager saying, forgive me, teenagers out there, because I know you're probably all much more evolved than I was when I was a teenager. But it's like a teenager saying, I don't want to listen to what you're saying, you adults. You know, you don't know anything. Well, you know, maybe not. I don't know.
The teenager might be more accurate. But yeah, I mean, to me, so I've been a lifelong fan of science fiction and fantasy.
God bless you.
And you know, it's to me, to hear people say, well, that's not serious literature. That's just entertainment, fluffy stuff. That's, you know, to really get into literature is to delve into an unimaginative world that we are actually trapped in our daily lives. That doesn't speak to me. That doesn't necessarily inspire me to work towards social change. Whereas when we, in the realm of fantasy, which covers so much from amazingly brilliant works of imagination and speculative fiction to, you know, the trite and the, you know, quick entertainment read. It can all be in that field. And to sort of categorize it all as this make-believe stuff that is meaningless misses the point so very much.
Well, make-believe stuff is exactly where we have our ideas about mm-hmm. where we're going to go next.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't imagine it, we certainly can't live it. Walida Emerisha, who's our very own Aragonian, who I think you're going to have on the show, she has a wonderful phrase. I think she invented it, visionary fiction, which I'm now using. Thank you, Walida. To describe the kind of fiction that you and I love so much,
mm-hmm.
Which is fiction that envisions different ways of doing things and different worlds for a purpose, to move the world forward or to move the world into a different story than right. the one that we're in right now. You use the verb trapped, and I think that's a very accurate verb for a lot of the literature that we're seeing now. It's trapped in a hierarchical structure. It's trapped in the idea that there are certain things that cannot happen. Ursula K. Le Guin's work was about saying that's not so. Many, many, many things can happen. In The Left Hand of Darkness, she said her favorite line ever was something she wrote in that, and I can't remember it exactly, but it was something like, "The king was 3 months pregnant."
Yes.
Which is a great line. And that immediately opens up. I mean, you just—it's like they say in Zen, you know. I was immediately enlightened. Mm-hmm. And now that we hear that Tammy Duckworth is pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. And you know that a sitting senator being pregnant—that's never happened. And how is that going to change the way that we look at governing? And how is that going to change? I hope it helps change things, because Lord knows we're having a pushback right now.
Right. Well, you know, I just want to, first of all, in The Left Hand of Darkness, we see Le Guin's writing on gender and in a completely different take on how the characters, how people are come into their genders. And this blew my mind as a teenager when I was first reading Le Guin. And in just sort of seeing, you know, I figured I was queer, yes, this and that, but to see characters interacting in non-binary ways, right? To see characters not be trapped in the very strictly enforced gender binary world was so completely liberating, and an opening of my own eyes to other ways of being.
Absolutely, and that's critical. That's the purpose of it.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned earlier that Le Guin was always pushing back and pushing forward, and that reminds me of her work, "Always Coming Home," which is it's fiction, but it's fiction told in story fragments and poetry. Art, and in the original published novel, It also came with a cassette tape of the music and poetry of the Kesh, the people that populated this work. And it was written as sort of storytelling as well as sort of an anthropological look at a culture that had been or may be still coming into being after this world changes significantly. And to play with the concepts of never really being sure if we're looking at the past or the future in that book, again, I thought was brilliant in how we see ourselves as a link in our history.
Yeah, and having us reimagine, having us step outside the concepts of linear time, that's always been a really important thing in science fiction, obviously,
yeah.
Stepping outside linear time. And obviously, physics finally caught up with that, that linear time is our construct, that we are making the meaning of linear time as we live it, but it's not necessarily what's happening outside of our story.
Right.
There's so many things going on outside of our story. It always amazes me when people think that we're just this tiny little thing and that we can't do anything, that we're helpless.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she gave to me. I think that's what she gave to millions of people was you're not helpless.
And that, in fact, we all have these rich stories and we are a part of the,
and that you have a responsibility to tell and that you have a responsibility mm-hmm. to interact with other people's stories. Yeah.
And speaking of a responsibility to interact, I want to go ahead and throw out the invitation to our listeners to join us in this conversation this morning. We are looking at speculative fiction, visionary fiction, the role of the imagination and story in radical social change work. I'm Ani. My guest this morning on Positively Revolting is Todd Davies, an author and publisher in her own right. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. As we mark the passing of Ursula K. Le Guin, longtime Portlander and just brilliant author, leaving us with more than 50 years of written work. You know, it's true. I first thought of the show because I needed a way to grieve and to share this moment, which I feel is quite significant in our lives, with each other and to be with each other and to look at how we are affected by the storytellers that are here now and by the stories that they have left behind.
Yeah, Tube is a mighty ancestress.
Indeed.
For sure. And while we're waiting for someone to call, because mm-hmm. Ani, I know Ani is highly interactive and so am I, what I want to mention is Ursula K. Le Guin's mother's work.
Oh, yes, please.
Her father, you know, was Alfred Kroeber, the very famous anthropologist, mm-hmm. and her mother was Theodora Kroeber, who wrote the book Ishi about the Native American who was the last of his tribe because his tribe had been completely extinguished in the Sierra Nevadas, and how Ursula K. Le Guin's father was the person who brought Ishi to San Francisco and actually befriended him and lived with him for the rest of, you know, kept in touch with him for the rest of his life, which I think was the source for a lot of her looking at culture from outside mm-hmm. and saying there's a different culture out there, there's a dying culture. But in Ishi, which is a nonfiction book, what Theodora Kroeber is doing is she is building a case for actual connection across culture, that because Kroeber, her husband, is a character in the book, and Ishi is a character, and they are living beings who communicate across this enormous culture. Ishi was a Stone Age tribesman who was brought to San Francisco. So I just think about what effect that must have had on Ursula K. Le Guin's work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How amazing that was, that both her parents could relate outside of their own little box that academia was in, you know, where tribesmen were meant to be studied, you know, as objects, not meant to be friends, as a partnership arrangement. And the
right.
whole book is about how there was this friendship that came across between the two of them, of equality, not of a famous anthropologist studying a Stone Age tribesman.
Right.
What a legacy.
Right, absolutely. And that perspective is everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is, again, looking at our relation to the world and our relation to each other in a very radical and very revolutionary way as egalitarians.
That's right. It's the KABU perspective.
Right. And so often, excuse me, especially in dominant culture, you know, we have and this gets me into where I want to sort of take our conversation next. Looking at telling stories that are new and challenging ourselves to notice our blind spots.
Yeah.
You know, because if we're not challenging very basic assumptions about how we interact and how we shape our societies, then really we're doing ourselves a disservice by accepting, say, capitalism, as we started off with that quote, as just sort of the natural order of things. It's just what happened. It's, you know, something that we are disempowered by rather than it's the story we've created around ourselves.
That's right. And another issue about that is a disempowerment is to only fight and react to things. That's disempowering.
Yes.
As well. Fighting is a tool, but to only react. George Lakoff, you know, the linguist, mm-hmm. has done a lot of work about that and is really doing a lot of work right now because it's so important, saying that what happens when you just react to things that you think, to a story mm-hmm. that you find offensive, what you're doing is you're actually strengthening that story.
Right.
You're not putting up a separate story which strengthens and gets adherence instead. And that's what we really need to be doing. We need to be looking at ourselves and saying, are we just getting angry and snarky because it's easier than the pain of having to go inside and find something new? We have to keep asking ourselves that, because finding something new and building it is what we need to be doing right now.
Absolutely. It also reminds me, so for many years I co-hosted the show. We started the show with a woman named Melody Silverwolf, who passed on several years ago now. But we used to do public ritual, and occasionally some different social change groups would ask us to come in and do some sort of, you know, invocation, blessing thing to help to create a new way of being. And we would often use an exercise of manifestation and banishment. We would go around in the group in a counterclockwise sort of way and ask people what they wanted to get rid of from this world. And everyone wanted to go around two or three times. Like, we all know what we want to get rid of. And then we would go around in the clockwise way, and I don't know, probably about a third, if not more, of the people would routinely say, I skip, pass, go to the next one.
It's too hard.
Right? And that, I think, is really at the crux of our issues, right? It is so easy to see examples of what we don't want. But it is so challenging to remake, to find new ways of being. And again, that is why I think that speculative fiction, visionary fiction, challenges us to do that and is an essential part of social change.
Oh, definitely. That image is going to stay with me forever, Ani. That's a great one. Because you know, it's also such a metaphor for the prevalence of dystopian fiction over utopian fiction.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's so much. I mean, there is a place for dystopian fiction. Don't get me wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, Margaret Atwood and her Oryx and Crake and Handmaid's Tale, you know, these... It's super important, because as we see our story actually externalized and see where things can well end up if we continue the paths, you know, these are our big warning sort of allegorical stories. That's important.
It
helps us focus.
Totally. But I wouldn't put Margaret Atwood's work as dystopian. I would rather put it, because when I say utopian fiction, I don't really mean fiction about a wonderful world that we would all want to live in, although that would be great if I could find that such a thing. But what she is doing is she is saying how to develop past that.
Yeah.
She's not, when I say dystopian fiction, I mean the stuff that essentially says the entire world is garbage.
Right.
And there is nothing to be done about it.
Right, right.
There's, I mean, we all know those books. There's tons of them. There's tons of them in literature. There's tons of them everywhere. Some of them are great, and some of them, you know, are really, you know, they point out things that we should know. But really, a book that leaves you feeling helpless at the end is not what we want right now.
No.
And Margaret Atwood does not leave you feeling helpless at the end.
That's
Margaret
true.
Atwood, yeah. She lifts you up. She is another mighty ancestress, and I'm very grateful she's still here.
Absolutely. Well, we do have some listeners joining us, and I want to invite folks, if you would like to do that same thing, you can call us at 503-231-8187 this morning. And let's go ahead and talk to Sue. Good morning. You're on the air, Sue.
Hi. Thanks, Annie, so much for having this program. This is I really needed this, and I just have to say, she's just been such an inspiration to my life. But my very first fantasy novel that I read was Left Hand of Darkness, which opened up my entire world and, like, just basically said, wait a minute, we can think about a world in a totally different way. But I was still a teenager, but just fabulous book, and, you know, whole different lines of thought came out of that, and she just kept on doing that her whole life. It was fabulous.
Absolutely.
Oh, it's so true.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with us. And you know, it's I think, again, you had, Sue mentions that she read Left Hand of Darkness as a teenager. I know I did. And what a gift to be able to benefit from this perspective, you know, at an early age, so that as we are developing, we are taking these stories in and using them to shape our relation to the world and ourselves.
Unfortunately, I didn't read her as a teenager because I was under the impression that science fiction was all guys and lots of technical stuff, which I was not in the slightest bit interested in. The only thing I was interested in, I loved Ray Bradbury because he was kind of in the same wheelhouse as Ursula K. Le Guin, who I didn't find till later, which is that he was about relationships and about humanity, really, about what it is that makes us human rather than what is it that makes us go to Mars?
Yes.
That's so interesting to me. So you guys were lucky.
Yeah. Well, you know, I consider a lot of my luck based on the fact that I'm born in Portland.
Yeah.
And that I went to a little alternative high school that Ursula Le Guin had connections with. And, you know, Metropolitan Learning Center, yes, Portland Public Schools, a tiny little school in Northwest Portland, and Ursula came and read to us. And
well, of course, you're younger than I am, and in my age group, what was happening was just what she was fighting against, too, was there was this feeling that women shouldn't write science fiction.
Right.
I mean, that it was a boys' club, that Brian Aldiss, I mean, she wrote that famous letter saying, why would I give a blurb to a book where Brian Aldiss is going to be insulting one of my stories? You know?
Right. Yeah.
God bless her.
It's absolutely true. And in my, you know, in my teens, I started working with science fiction conventions and volunteering for them. And again, now, you know, we would often have wonderful women that would be there, like Ursula Le Guin, but we also definitely had the naysayers, and you know, if your rocket ship wasn't the biggest and the fastest, and you know, you had all the pseudoscience that would make it so that this was where the interest was, and all this other stuff was fluffy. It was, you know, it was about relationships, and that's kind of girl stuff, and that's suspect at best. Where's your space bunny costume? You know,
what I want to know is what shape are the rocket ships?
Yeah, like that. 503-231-8187, the number to call this morning to join us on the air. I'm Ani. This is Positively Revolting, and we are speaking with Todd Davies this morning. Todd, talk about your own, if you could, just for a moment, the world that you're creating in the Arcadia series.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, really, it came out of the fact that I was thinking there are certain places in the world that are blessed, you know, that seem to be living in harmony, and they're small communities usually that have relationships and connections and have a happy life, and then they're surrounded by this culture that seems to be bearing down on them, trying to take all of that away. And how does a smaller culture like that actually defend itself without becoming part of the larger issue? Because once you start fighting with something, you cannot help but become what the thing you're fighting against as well.
Yeah.
You just can't. It's a biological fact. So I think that was the beginning of it, because I was going back and forth between Liverpool, England, and an extremely blasted neighborhood where I had was working with a group to set up a TV studio that kids would go into and make their own television programs. And then I would come back home to Oregon, and the difference between Oregon and the small community that I live in and that was so dramatic that I was starting to think, how could you spread out the happiness and the harmony that you can find in a smaller community that actually is supported and supports its individuals? How can you spread that out rather than having that crushed by a community that I was living in Liverpool, where there were 12-year-old children who couldn't read?
Right,
So, genesis of the Arcadia stories, and it's endlessly fascinating to me, because I really want to know how can people evolve so that they understand so that all of us understand that we are all connected, and that what we do to one another, we are actually doing to ourselves. And how can we then realize that we're connected to nature and understand how that should occur, rather than this endless dominance and hierarchy structure that we've built up? And I think that was my analysis, which of course is the KABU analysis, and of course is the revolutionary analysis, which is that the structure that we've got presently is a dominance and hierarchy one. Somebody's always got to be on the top,
right,
and somebody's always got to be on the bottom. And that is what Ursula K. Le Guin's work subverted all the time.
Yes.
She was constantly saying somebody does not have, I mean, it's situational. Sometimes someone's got to be in charge, but it is not inherent in our biology that someone's got to be on the top and someone's got to be on the bottom.
Right.
Left Hand of Darkness that we keep talking about is the most obvious example of that. But the word for the world is forest is another really poignant working out of that. Why? How can a people who live in the forest, who have a completely different culture, how can they preserve what they have against vicious colonialism?
Yeah.
You know? So that was, I mean, that all sounds very abstract, but really what happens when you're writing is the characters just start talking to you, and you just love them or hate them or whatever, and that's it. And you look back at it and figure out why you did what you did, but you don't really know when you're doing it, truthfully.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and talk to Craig. Good morning, Craig. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for this very insightful program. I'm really enjoying it.
Great.
I'm learning a lot. I've been in Oregon since 71, after graduating from college as a river guide, coming from California, and went to an experimental college. So alternatives have been a part of my life and my consciousness since the 60s. And my family had a cabin up in Jonesville, if you went to the top of the mountain where four counties intersected, you looked down into the Deer Creek area where Ishi lived.
Mm.
And it was a phenomenal, you know, experience to just try to sense what it must have been like for him to be the last of his people.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think that the takeaways for today are so powerful if we can let them in.
Okay.
It's difficult to, but I think it's time to, and I think it's also time for us to realize that the religions that man has created that puts heaven in the clouds seem to trash the planet with impunity. Mm-hmm. Whereas the religions, the indigenous cultures, which saw heaven and earth, heaven on earth, they wouldn't dream of trashing the planet. And how can we incorporate and synthesize that concept?
Excellent, excellent question. Thanks
very
much.
Yeah, and I think that's what speculative fiction is meant to be looking into, and visionary fiction is meant to be looking at.
Well, and as we talk about Ishi again, you know, it strikes me, you know, with that as an early influence in Le Guin's life, it puts into perspective pretty sharply how she saw colonizer cultures, you know, how she saw the conquest of lands and worlds, you know, and it never really looked very good for the colonizer, I just have to say.
No, quite brutal. But then she also had the Hain, which was a wonderful invention. The Hain being a culture that actually had populated the Earth, had populated all of these different planets with different kinds of worlds to see how they would play out. And while that's a little colonialist and a little, you know, blah, 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 sometimes I would read about the Hain in her work and I would think, I wonder if that's her father. You know?
Mm.
I wonder if that was... Because it was so benevolent as well,
right?
Benevolent and brilliant and big, right?
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, so that was fascinating. I love that concept of the Hain.
Absolutely, and so many of her works involved this, you know, the Hainish cycle, basically the Rokkanen's world, Left Hand of Darkness, The Dispossessed, all come from that particular perspective of Le Guin's imagination.
And The Dispossessed, oh my gosh.
The Dispossessed, yeah.
What an amazing book. And also wonderful because she's showing what a fantasy utopia would be like and how it could then be very constricted.
Yeah.
That the world that he lives on is the world that people who wanted change on the earth and couldn't stand it anymore, that they weren't getting it, went and built essentially their own world. And then they got just as constricted. It's a wonderful book. It's really all of her work is really wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, watch the development.
You know, including the nonfiction, Steering the Craft, which is her book on writing and creative writing exercises, has been one of my favorites on the subject since I first laid my hands on it. Also, her interpretation of the Tao Te Ching.
Oh, yeah, that is great.
Amazing, just amazing work.
And she says something really wonderful in one of her books of essays. She says that the world has gotten so completely yang. Our world, you know, the Western world, has gotten so completely yang that we have to yank it back to yin.
Mm.
Really true.
Mm-hmm.
That it's gotten so gross, must go forward, must attack, that we have to yank it back to must contemplate, must meditate, must calm down, you know, essentially, and put them back into balance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what all of her work was about, was watching the balance tip one way and it trying to be pulled back into another way, which is the world. The word for the world is forest. That's what that is about.
Absolutely.
For sure.
503-231-8187, the number to call this morning to join us on the air. This is Positively Revolting. You are listening to KABU, your very own community radio station. I want to let you know, coming up later on this morning at 9 o'clock, One Land, Many Voices, exploring Israel's attempt to censor the boycott divestment sanctions movement. At 10 o'clock, you'll hear Valley Views presenting its part two of its practical and affordable energy-saving techniques that will help reduce your carbon footprint. At 10:15, Flashpoints will be on the air with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Pacific Underground talks to Nadia Okamoto about her article entitled, "Until 3 months ago, I was ashamed of being Asian." You'll hear all of this and so much more today on KABU, your independent source for news and for music, for poetry, for literature, for all of it. Just become a member. Support this work. Go to kboo.fm and click donate. You can Also, if you enjoy Positively Revolting, you know coming together once a week is just not enough. You can follow along on Facebook. You can like our page there, Positively Revolting. You can also follow us in the Twitterverse, at Positive Revolt. Let's go ahead and, again, if you would like to call in, perhaps you have other authors you want to mention, other folks who have influenced you, or stories that you have found super inspiring in your own work. What has informed your vision? What has informed your praxis in this world? You know, let's go ahead and hear about that. We have Pear on the line right now, but let's have you call in, too, at 503-231-8187. And with all that, good morning, Pear.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, Pear.
I'm wondering why it seems to me a lot of futuristic fiction in the social setup is more like feudalism. You know, they have barons and earls and dukes and all that kind of stuff. And it seemed kind of an anomaly.
Yeah. That's a really good question. What do you think, Ani?
You know, I think it goes back to the we create what we know. Right. And that, you know, I started off this morning sort of asking that question. How do we challenge ourselves to recognize our own blind spots? How do we challenge ourselves to make sure that we're not sort of taking something at face value because it's familiar? And, well, that's just the way the world is. How do we challenge ourselves to go deeper?
Well, I was thinking of Dune, you know.
Uh-huh. I mean, yeah.
There's a big section where the young hero he gets coached in swordplay or something like that. And it's interesting because I knew Frank Herbert. We worked on the copy desk of the San Francisco newspaper. And he's a very funny guy, you know. He really was, but his novel, at least Dune, was so dead serious and everything.
Very.
Seems kind of strange. But
fear is the mind killer, Pear.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like maybe an interesting story would be how a lot of the dystopian fiction we see, they glide over the how it all happened, and you're all of a sudden, you know, you have people in this desolated world, you know, wandering around killing each other or something. But the interesting story might be how it got that way, or say if we do have a new kind of feudalism, you know, take an ordinary, say, a small town cut off from the economy, which has crashed anyway, and how a feudalism would develop there.
So that's a good idea, and let me suggest another possibility, because this also takes us to Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea books.
Ah, nice, okay.
Which do go right back to what you were talking about, Pear. So the feudalist period was one where we could have chosen to go a bunch of different ways as a culture, and really capitalism and the present culture that we've got now came out of that. Didn't it? I mean, the Empire period came out of the Tudors,
sure.
That period. And before that, before they started with the enclosures and with imperialism and with travel to explore other worlds and colonize them, we sort of had choices about where to go. And it could also possibly be that we're going back to that to re-envision how it would go if it went a different direction. That's possible. Because I also find when in my own writing, it's really hard to work machinery in and have it be at all romantic or have it be at all harmonious. Somehow it clashes. It's really hard to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I sort of think it's because it's moving toward a more, that line is moving more toward human beings becoming less human, which I think we see in the AI strain,
uh-huh.
You know, where humans are trying to become more than human so they won't be dead, they won't die.
Right.
Well, if the economy crashes, you know, if the economy crashes, then I think...
That's right.
Machinery.
Keep going. Keep going. I can see where you're going, but you finish. Finish what you're saying.
Well, machinery is sort of useless, and the whole AI robot thing is kind of useless because it has to run on fuel.
Right.
That's right.
It might not be available, and...
That's right.
Are you
and what does it's like a running away from what does it mean to be human,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And that, and I think if you don't mind me getting back to Ursula K. Le Guin, all of her work was about what does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
What do we do to be better humans? Humans. Yeah. What does
you mentioned
human
one
mean?
Thing. you know, you mentioned one thing earlier about, you know, how does a society fight back without becoming like its adversary? And I'm thinking maybe the best example would be the Zapatistas.
Yes. Yes. Explain.
Yeah.
Say why you think that. Yes.
Well, they've been around for quite a while, ever since 1995 when they first rebelled. And that rebellion was thought, was sort of conceived long before. They don't, apparently in the Zapatista, the Mayan culture, they really discuss things for a long time before they do anything. It's kind of like that, you know, they achieve consensus.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so here they are. You know, they're being besieged by the Mexican government and some of these death squads, but they're surviving and they're building this society, and it's a very egalitarian society, and it's you know, it's not primitive, but it's not a it's not sort of this mechanistic, you know, kind of thing. So I think they're an inspiration, and they're still around. They don't make a big splash. They don't get in the news a whole lot, but there they are.
Absolutely. And I'm going to throw in that they do it in a very egalitarian, you know, there is no dominator.
That's right.
You know,
and you should, and we should also remember that when the Western press reported on them, the only time it was at all interested in them, it framed the story as being they were led by Subcomandante Marcos, who was a, you know, mysterious male.
Right.
And he kept saying, no one would listen in the newspapers, but he kept saying, I'm not running this.
Right.
I'm not running this. You know,
right.
here's Subcomandante Ramona, who was
right.
like in her 70s and is 4'2".
Yeah.
Why don't you write about her?
Yeah.
No,
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Pierre, for bringing that up.
Oh, you bet.
A lot to say about that. Let's, you know, we had a caller asking for suggestions of who we found inspirational. I want to hear from more listeners about who they find inspirational, but a very short list to just sort of throw it out there. First of all, when you're talking about writing about machines and technology and not having it be jarring and disharmonious in a world that we are trying to make sustainably, I'm going to go ahead and give a nod to Starhawk, actually.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah, her work of The Fifth Sacred Thing and all of its sequels, I think just did a brilliant job of that.
Oh, yes. No, her work is fantastic. And it's just in the same wheelhouse of what we're talking about now.
Yeah, absolutely. I also...
Madeleine L'Engle, another one.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Octavia Butler.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are so many. Margaret Atwood, we had mentioned earlier. I would also throw in... Jewel Gomez, who wrote a very interesting vampire series, the Gilda stories, that I found an interesting way of looking at relationship and the world. There are so many authors that I've been inspired by and, you know, that inform how I see myself in this world and how I want to see the world shaped around us. Let's go ahead and hear from you, callers. 503-231-8187. Who else do you find inspirational?
Oh, you know, the Lord of the Rings series. I mean, it's gotten really, really covered over because people fight and say, oh, it's about elves. Oh, it's about this. And somebody said on Twitter the other day, it was just an excuse for him to have a world where he could say what everybody was wearing. I mean, that's really missing the point. It was like,
yes.
It's actually one long scream of anguish about what had happened in his world because of World War I and World War II. And he lived in Oxford, which I know very well, and which is a beautiful place. And he was absolutely devastated by the destruction that had come to Oxford through the automobile, for example, and the cutting down of the trees.
Yes.
I mean, this actually put him in actual despair, and he wrote these books as a result of that. So that it was quite. And I remember Ursula Le Guin writing in a review. She said she didn't want to read it because she thought it was just going to be another guy, you know, with more elves and more. And she just was sick of that. And then she started reading it, and she thought, "Oh my gosh, I'm totally wrong. This is actually genius." So, and I totally am with her on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead and talk to Edith. Good morning, Edith.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I want to share one of my favorite authors and a series of books that greatly influenced my political activism and strengthened me through hardships. It's Kate Sherrity. It's pronounced with an S-H, but it's spelled S-E-R-E-D-Y. She has beautiful, beautiful black and white drawings, very elaborate details, idealizing a Hungarian, you know, background or the American ideal. And she would give a really vital, powerful vision of people who are loving and kind and working for social justice in family relations, in looking at nature and animals, and it was a very powerful anti-war. My favorite book was The Chestry Oak. It was this little boy who was a prince in Hungary as the Nazis were taken over, and how he and the horse, a stallion, went through the war and were confused and misunderstood and thought they were crazy or wild or whatever, and then they reconnect in America. But it was powerfully showing how no matter where you are in the social class or horrific wars around you, as you're having economic change, as you're having disabilities, as you're being tortured, whatever it is, that sense of love and that commitment to the greater ideal and to others and personal integrity, and how it comes through. She would have factual things as in the singing tree after a mass war, a battleship. So it gave me what I needed when I had no family or friends or society showing what a non-abusive way to relate. It made me be able to stand up for oppressed people, even when I'm being shot by cops. It helped me be persevering in my prayers and expand my questioning of my taken-for-granted beliefs. They're written for children, and all the books, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn or whatever, they may have a tree and a sweet child, but it gives a bigger vision of what government, what society, what religion can be, what families can be. And I really encourage you, especially if you feel cynical or depressed, to read Kate Sherrity.
What a great suggestion. I mean, I'm really going to look for her now.
Thank you very much, Edith.
Yeah. And she brings up another really good point, which is that to scorn children's books is just foolish. And to scorn fairy tales as being, quote unquote, just for children is really foolish.
Totally missing the point, I think.
Totally missing the point. Wind in the Willows is probably the best English book ever written. I mean, really, Kenneth Graham. I have a copy next to my bed, which I read whenever I'm depressed.
That's
it's
wonderful.
Fabulous. No, you guys are all laughing, but honestly.
That's wonderful, yeah.
It's the story of a world the way the world really could be. And, just read it again.
Again, yeah.
If you haven't read it in years, read it again.
Yeah, I am often, you know, I fell into the fresh adulthood trap of not wanting to read something that was labeled young adult fiction or children's books, you know, for a while because I'm in my 20s. I'm going to move on. I'm going to read. And, you know, now...
Hemingway.
Right. Yeah, right. I have to bore myself now.
Joyce Carol Oates.
Somehow or another, when I was in my 40s, I found the strength to go back and revisit and realized those labels are really meaningless because the stories that often are labeled for young adults or children's fiction do have a wonderful way of imagining the world and have wonderful stories to tell us.
And of course, C.S. Lewis said, someday you will be old enough to read fairy tales.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Let's go ahead and squeeze one more person in. Let's go ahead and talk to Walker. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. I was calling to suggest that a real good person to read is Leslie Silko.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. Leslie Mormon Silko. Yeah. The Almanac of the Dead is the work I'm most familiar with of hers.
That's really good. Ceremony is very, very good. And it has to do with a lot of the themes that have been talked about this morning. She in Almanac of the Dead, of course, she delves into the what she didn't say was the Zapatistas, but it was certainly a good description of.
It's actually because it was written. It was written pretty much concurrently. It was not. It was an imagined struggle, but it ended up being pretty much the story of the Zapatista uprising, which I found phenomenal.
Yeah, and of course, Ceremony has a lot to do with the aftermaths of war and the effects of developing so-called atomic energy on the world, as seen from the point of view of the Pueblo peoples. It's very good too.
Right. Hey, thank you. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, that's another great suggestion. Yeah, I've got to go to the library tomorrow.
And actually, Almanac of the Dead was written. It was published in 1991. The Zapatistas had their uprising and first noticed by the rest of the world on New Year's Day 1994. But again, when I was reading it about a couple years after that uprising, I thought, how is it that she predicted this so dead on? I will say the one thing, and I just have to note it because I find this book phenomenal and I would recommend it to everyone to read over and over again, but I am really troubled, I'll say troubled, by her portrayal of gay characters. The only gay characters in the book are the bad guys, and I find that interesting.
The other.
Yeah, and it makes me want to have a conversation with her sometime. I don't know.
Well, that would be really interesting.
Wouldn't it? Okay, well, I'll work on that. I'll put that one together soon. Meanwhile, we have...
You're so creative, Ani.
We have one more person. Let's see if we can squeeze Keen in for just about 1 minute. Good morning, Keen. What do you have to say?
Good morning. I'm glad I made it in.
Yeah.
I just wanted to recommend to everybody someone who I've been reading as long as I can remember, Isabel Allende.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Most of her stuff is, linked historically, but her discussions about class and colonization and stuff are really quite amazing.
Yeah.
I'll go back and reread her.
Yeah,
she just has a brand new book out that I just got for Christmas called In the Midst of Winter, and it's really quite an incredible story about... immigrants who get involved in life in New York City.
Fantastic. I think a lot of her early works, especially, very, very important in the field. Thanks very much for your call, Keen. And with that, we have just about a minute left. Todd, thank you so much for joining us. What you got? Any final words? Any last inspirational thoughts?
Oh, just keep reading and keep thinking and keep telling your own stories, because we're all connected, and what's coming out of your unconscious is coming into the consciousness of everybody else too.
Absolutely. Thank you, Todd Davies, for joining us this morning. It's always such a treat to be able to talk with you. What do you have going on? You're working on the last the fourth part of the Arcadia series?
I just finished what I hope is the almost final draft. I got put back. I got put back a few months, but
right.
The book itself I want to have come out this year because it's the 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was something we could talk about at some other point, because Mary Shelley is
really an incredible ancestress as well. And this is my version of Frankenstein in the Arcadia world, and it's told by the scientist who has created a godman, he hopes, and the result of that. So
fantastic.
Yeah, so, and it's really terrific fun to write and terrific fun to be on Positively Revolting, which is one of my favorite names for a program ever, Annie. So, thank you very much.
Wonderful to have the chance to talk with you again, Todd Davies. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to have you back.
Oh, thank you. I'll come back anytime you want.
All right. Fantastic. I'll hold you to that. And please, dear listeners, stay tuned to KABU all morning long. Coming up right now, One Land, Many Voices. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. at George Middle School in Portland. The Fix-It Fair helps you learn simple ways to save money and connect with resources. Join your neighbors and talk to the experts about how to spend less and stay healthy. There will be exhibits and hourly workshops on water and energy savings, food and nutrition, neighborhood and community resources, weatherizing your home, transportation, a repair cafe, and much more, with childcare and lunch provided. Again, that's the Fix-It Fair on Saturday, January 27th, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at George Middle School, 10,000 North Burr Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This year, 2018, KABU is celebrating our 50th anniversary. Throughout 2018, we'll be featuring many of the gems from KABU's archives on our second stream, available exclusively through KABU's website, kboo.fm/historystream. We'll feature such speakers as Margaret Mead, Bell Hooks, Dick Gregory, John Trudell, early computer hacker Captain Crunch, and audio coverage of the 1968 Democratic National Convention, as well as much, much more. You can find this stream on our website at kboo.fm